you guys. I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name's Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1546. We have the series that began way back in September of 1982. You'll also hear tonight John, KC2, WGB, with a mailbag. He also monitors the Echo Link, so if people have trouble signing in, we know about it. I don't think we've got anybody monitoring IRLP, but maybe someday we will. You'll also be hearing Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report. And I think tonight we might receive space report number 139 of this series. You'll also be hearing occasionally from Hal, K6DPZ, who's got a lot of experience with a lot of radio equipment. The guys who listen to the TechNet gather here. Their major motivation is education. This is a gathering the clan of curious ham radio operators, the guys who want to know how things work. So we try to teach each other antennas and transmitters and receivers and transmission lines and standing wave ratio and propagation and satellites. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. Let me jump. So if you, arguably it's one of the most educational hobbies you can get involved in. Electronics, and particularly wireless electronics, is really ruling our life these days. You could go down the list of all the wireless products that people use in the United States, and it's about 20 different products. They're all connected by a transmitter, antennas, and a receiver, and some form of exotic or simple modulation on all of that jazz. There was a good flea market today, or a hammer-rammer hamvention. So some people got some pretty good buys, and we'll be hearing about that. I'll be asking you guys later on who bought what that you're happy with. I think we heard that Hank bought himself a nice set of calipers, I heard earlier tonight. Okay, the way a person signs in, because you do have a question or a comment, is to give that crowd of four guys, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not to sign in just to let us know you're listening. After 32 years of TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. So if you do have a real question or a comment, do please sign in. Okay, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, MDP, Steve, and yes.
WA2RYY. Joe, yes.
Very fine. So far we got Steve and Joe. Anyone else that I missed? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Do we know the question?
Okay, we got Rich. So far Steve, Joe, and Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. I doubled with somebody. Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, one more call. Anyone else wants to sign into the TechNet right now, because you do have a question or comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
NWS2N, Paul is here with the space report.
And I hope you're going to tell me about this brand new thing called Voyager. I hear tell that it's really way out there, Paul. That's a joke. Paul and I have this running joke about Voyager. Exactly how many astronomical units is it out there today? Is it out there 12 billion miles? Is the round trip communication to it 36 hours or something like that at the speed of light? That is the most distant piece of electronics mankind has ever created. That's going to be the record holder for a long time to come. Not even the James Webb telescope, when it goes up in 2018, is going to even come close. Okay. One last call. Anyone with the call letters and name, because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name right now.
Quick information, Dick.
Okay, John, give us the quick information.
You notice we don't have the four tones because of the time difference. It probably won't establish the four tones until 9, but people should remember to delay just so we can keep everybody hooked up. Okay, that's it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, what John is basically saying is listen to the three tones, even though we don't have all four tones tonight. Beep, boop, boop, beep. That's what you normally have when it's in the net mode. And because of the machine not being reset for daylight saving time, we're in the not-net node for the first hour. So, before coming back after a conversation of somebody else, I'll wait till you hear three tones and maybe ask a, wait another second or two just to be sure. First guy on the list was Steve, KC2MDP. I have some fun with Steve when I say, Steve will discuss anything except antennas and transmission lines. What would you like to talk about tonight, Steve? KC2MDP? K2IW, you got it.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I don't have a antenna question tonight. I actually have a computer question. I got a couple of the Baofeng radios, and I bought the programming software over at the Hamfest today. It wasn't expensive. It was a couple of bucks. And I'm having trouble getting it to work. In other words, it basically, it doesn't recognize the radio. As far as the drivers and everything for the USB, the serial that you plug into the radio, that seems fine. I was wondering if anybody out there had any problems or issues with this thing, and what should I look for? Back to you.
Comment, Dick.
I'm going to say a couple of words and then turn it over to John. I do remember hearing people a few months ago saying that there's two cables that claim to be able to be connecting between the radio and your computer. And one of those cables worked very well, and one of those cables was very troublesome. That was one of the issues. Let's see what John remembers from that. KC2WGP, K2LAW. KC2WGP, I'll get you right. Hang in there, John. You're a newcomer, right? K2LAW listening.
Yeah, definitely a newcomer. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. It has to do with the chip ID that's in that connection cable. And if you don't have the right one, yeah, you can suffer. Back to you, Dick.
Now, let's find out, John, do you remember, and I should have waited for the beeps, do you remember anybody finding a solution to the chip that's in the not-so-friendly cable? Or is the only solution to buy a new computer or go out and buy a new cable? What have people found as a solution in the past, John? You got it, John. K2LAW, the TechNet.
Dick, most people borrowed a working cable from someone who had a successful download. That's how most of them did it. Otherwise, you have to go on the site and buy the exact cable. Now, maybe he has the exact cable and has some other problem, but most of it's been the cable itself, Dick.
Okay, let's see if we've got anybody on frequency who has done that interfacing of the cable, their computer, and a Baofeng. And although the computer, the programming sequence is very different compared to other American-made products or other handy-talkies you've seen in the past, it is possible to learn how to program it from the front panel of the Baofeng. And my son has learned it, and he's a computer whiz, and to him it's easy. And one of my other friends named Bill also has learned it. So although you have to learn it from somebody who has been through the process, I have the impression from what I've heard that the owner's manual, which is written in Chinglish, really doesn't lead you in the right direction in a way that's understandable. So you may not be able to find out from the owner's manual, but talk to the right person and you will be able to program it from the front panel. And I do recommend you at least learn it as a backup, because the day will happen. You're in your automobile in the field. You don't have a computer in that cable nearby, and you want to add some new frequency to your Baofeng. So learning that is a way to go. Now, when it comes to programming Baofeng and having the right cable, anybody along these lines, please give me your call letters right now. K2LAW on the TechNet. Okay, I may have it wrong. It sounded like Kilo Delta 2 Charlie X-ray Oscar. Please correct me and tell me your name, sir, and then proceed with your information. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
Kilo Delta 2 Golf X-ray Lima. Ken is my name. I've programmed Baofeng using Chirp software, CHIRP. You can find it online, Google it, and give you all the directions on how to do it. You may have to download a specific driver to program the radio based on the version of Windows you're running.
Now, the real question, Ken, is that there are different chips in the cable, and if Steve happens to have the cable that's more troublesome, will he still be able to use Chirp that he can download into his particular computer, which may be his Windows-based. Will Chirp work with all cables, or is it possible he still has a cable interface problem? KD2 Golf X-ray Lima, K2RW, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, a lot of the problems seem when Windows updated from Vista to Windows 8 or 8.1. Most of the drivers that come with the software cable generally have to deal with the Vista. So if you're running Windows 8 or 8.1, you have to actually either download a specific driver that's geared towards Vista, and your computer will then recognize the cable. And then in the settings for Device Manager, it would tell you what the COM port is that cable is connected to, and when you run the software, you have to specify which COM port you're looking at, recognize the radio on.
Good information, Ken. Now, the serious question I can ask, because I don't know, what website do I go to find the Chirp program that I can download? Do I simply go to Alfang.com or something like that? Back to you, Ken. K2RIW.
The best way probably would be to Google it, find it. I believe it's danplanet.com. DanPlanet.com. I believe is the website that Chirp software found. There's another website, Miklor.com, that has a whole bunch of information about a lot of these radios as well.
Fantastic. So, in each of those sites, Miklor.com or DanPlanet.com, you can get Chirp. And a significant number of people with Baofangs and Luxongs built to the new FCC mandate of more narrow modulation are complaining about low audio. And so from time to time I hear tell that there's quite a few websites people have established where they give you information of various techniques to increase the deviation. Some of them are drilling a slightly larger hole in front of the microphone, moving the microphone element, changing the electronics on the audio inside, and whatever. So would either of those websites you just mentioned also have that kind of information, Ken? KD2GXL, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Yeah, that'd be affirmative. The Miklor.com has hints, tips, kind of open forum stuff on there as well about the type of radios.
Okay, let's see if Steve needs any fill in all of the above. KC2MDP, we're really going to wait for the beeps, and I didn't do that. You got it, Steve. K2RIW.
I guess that was it, one beep, okay. Yeah, here is my dilemma. Yes, there's new radios I got that don't have a keypad on it. Basically, they're 16-channel radios, no keypad, or otherwise that's what I have done. I did try the Chirp. I did try it with the, I think it's the 5R. I tried it with these new radios. Basically, the software that I got and the cable is supposed to be directly from Baofeng. I tried different drivers that they recommend, and still nothing. I'll give it back to you for any further comments.
Ken is the guy with the info. Let's see if Ken's got some further info and suggestions. You got it, Ken.
I don't know how new the radios are. They may not be supported yet by Chirp. I know they're adding new radios to the programming daily. Is daily build as well as the actual program. The most recent program was from October, but they add daily to it. So you have to check the daily build and Chirp. It may be supported there, I'm not sure.
So why don't you, Steve, tell us the model number of your Baofeng. Maybe that'll help a little bit. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Sure thing, Dick. Can you hang on for 2 seconds while I go in the other room and grab it?
Go for it.
2OSR.
W2OSR. K2LAW, go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, part of the problem with Baofeng is the individual radios, they keep changing the software in the radio itself. And you'll have one program that'll work with one of their models on one production run. They come out with another production run, they've got different programs, and you have to get another program to program them. adds a little confusion. That MicroFuse website, which is a basically a Baofeng usage group, has a manual in there, at least I know for the UR5 radio, which is very comprehensive, written in English that's understandable and explains how to program it from the keypad. Now, the one he's got may be one of their more commercial radios with the 16 channels, and that's maybe the only way to program it is with a computer. So you get into a ball of where they don't keep a certain standard and stay with it.
Yeah, he did say that he's got 16 channels with no keypad, so it doesn't sound like he stands a chance to program it from the front panel. And that's a little bit disappointing that even within a particular model number, you said UR5, that different production runs have different software requiring different download programs to run chirp from MCLAW. Oh boy, looks to me like they haven't had configuration management is what it's called in the military world. Let's hear if Steve is back. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. Okay, it's Baofeng. It's BF-A5. And I'm looking on the side of the box, and the manufacture date is 6th of 2014. So it's, you know, it's several months old, so maybe it is possible they don't have the software. And that is pretty pertinent information that they're changing the different configurations of how these things are programmed. Maybe that's my problem.
Now, the way you pronounce that, it sounded like the model number is Baker Foxtrot Alpha 5. Did I get that correct, Steve? Go ahead.
Yes, that is correct, Dick.
I wasn't quite sure if it was BF85 or BFA5. Alrighty. Anybody have any further suggestions for Steve as to how to create compatibility between his Baofeng BFA5, the cable he just bought today, and the chirp-like program that he's trying to run on his, I think, Windows system? And with any further comments, give me a call that is right now. K2LIW, the TechNet.
KD2CMB, with a comment.
VBN.
Okay, at the end I heard 2VBN. I think I know who that is. But before that was Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Papa. Start with your name, sir, and your information. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, how you doing? Phil from West Babylon. I just wanted to tell the user with the 16-channel radios, if you go on the Baofeng website, it's the BF480 software. It's a 2012 piece of software that pretty much does all this 16-channel UHF and VHF radios. Have them give that a try first, and then, you know, check the software for the cable. I've had good luck with that. I've had a lot of the Baofengs. As far as the UB5R, I use the original software from the Baofeng website and never had a problem. But again, because I do a lot of old radio work, I do use Vista, and that seems to be the key. I think some of the Windows 7 and 8 applications just don't like some of the foreign USB chips that are in the cables. And that's the end of my comment.
Good information, Bill. Thank you. Steve, do you need any fill on what Bill just gave us?
No, very good. That's great information. I will try the BF-480. I think that's on the disk, and if that doesn't work, maybe I will try an older computer. I think I have a laptop laying around here that's got XP or something on it. I thank everyone for the information, and if I do find any further information and get this thing going, I'll let you know next week. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we also had a comment from Mr. 2VBN. Give me your full call. I know you, but I can't give you a name right now. K2I, done the TechNet. Mr. VBN, you got it.
Yes, this is KB2, VBN, Far Rockaway. I got a question on the astrology side. I was on the astrology net last week. What's the name of the planet that's facing the north? The southwest. What's the name of the planet that's facing the southwest, lined up with the beach?
I'm going to make a guess that if it's a bright planet, it's Jupiter. Can anyone correct me on that one? I know we're going out of sequence here, but the the major planet right now is what I think he is asking. Anybody know? And one of the guys who definitely attends is John, KC2WGB. John, I'm going to pass it over to you. At the Astronomy Net, do you remember hearing what we should be looking for? You got a sign.
XK, come in.
GXK, pick it up.
So ironic. I happen to touch on this very second, and I hear this question. Good evening, it's Greg, KD2CXK. The bright object in the western sky is Venus, and there is a bright object in the southeastern sky, which is Jupiter. KD2CXK, back to net.
Okay, thank you, Craig. Mr. VBN, is that sort of the information you were looking for? Go right ahead.
Roger, I can see it from the beach. It's a big, gigantic star. I thought it was a star, but so it's the planet Venus, you see.
Yeah, I think Venus will be setting to the west, if I understand correctly, and probably very soon after sunset is when you see it. Is that approximately true, Craig?
Not right now, but it's on its way out. So, we don't have the greatest sky tonight, but I do see it. It is starting to fade. It was brighter an hour ago. This star is, this planet, I got tripped up there, is going to be its brightest at dusk. So that's probably the best time you want to look for it is after the sun is set, and it'll be in the western sky about, I'm going to say, a fifth of the way up.
Yeah, Venus is a inferior planet. Fancy way of saying that it's closer to the sun than we are. Therefore, you're going to see it not a very large number of degrees away from the sun. You'll never see it at midnight at, straight overhead, because that's only the planets that are further out from the sun than us. So, Venus is sometimes a morning star, sometimes an evening star. The word star was used in quotes. Obviously, it's a planet. And I think Venus is essentially the brightest thing in the sky after the sun and the moon. Let's see if I got that one correct, Craig. I think Venus is the brightest thing we ever see other than the sun and moon. KD2CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's correct. Venus is the brightest, and there's a couple of reasons. One is I'm going to give big points to its atmosphere. The amount of carbon dioxide and so forth in that atmosphere pretty much not only keeps the gases in, but there's a lot of reflection out. So it's pretty bright. The second thing is it's very close to our sun, so the sun doesn't have to work very hard to illuminate it. And finally, it is much closer to us than Jupiter. So these three things will contribute to it being very luminous. KD2CXK, back to NASA.
Thank you, Craig. So, let's see. Hopefully the sky will clear up a little bit better later on, Mr. VBN. Next guy on our list was Joe, to B2RYY. And go easy with us tonight, Joe. Sometimes you ask some pretty tough questions. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more comment?
You got it, Craig.
If you happen to have a telescope and you can look at Venus, Venus is also the only object in the sky that goes through phases like the moon. See, a crescent or a full plate or a waning and waxing gibbous.
Yeah, when Venus is closest to us, you're going to see it as a crescent, well, fairly large diameter. When it's on the backside of the sun from our point of view, it's going to be a hell of a lot smaller, but it's going to be a full planet, a full moon, so to speak. So it goes through all of these phases of waxing and waning and change in size. The moon is always the same size as it waxes and wanes because its elliptical orbit around us is fairly circular, whereas Venus is going around the sun, we're going around the sun, and except for the fact that we both go around the same sun, there were times when it's ahead of us, behind us, and the backside of the sun, and so on, but it's always closer to the sun than we are. Maybe that helps. Okay, good luck with that operation. Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening, W2RYY.
4YY here. My question has to do with heating systems. I know we've talked about the subject before, but here's another part of it. I don't remember if I've asked you this question previously or not. Ready for this one?
Yeah, I've been doing quite a bit of work with oil-fired heating systems in the last couple of days, but that's another whole story. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, first of all, the question arises from, I did some simple measurements on the electric usage of the burner that I have. I happen to have a Beckett burner. And I know it's running about like 3 amps of current, approximately. The circulator seems to take about a half an amp of current to run it when it's running. The transformer runs about 1 amp of current, so it leaves a remainder amp and a half, amp and 3/4, give or take, that run the actual blower motor assembly. My question is, does anybody make a time-operated switch where once you apply power to this device, it would give you, say, like 10 seconds of output at 120 volts and cut off? To cut off the transformer, because I found out that my burner, I don't know if other people have the same thing or it works all the same, but I found out that I don't really need the transformer as far as the ignition transformer in continuous operation. I'd like to try to put something in to cut out its usage to prolong its longevity, number one, and number two, cut out the electric usage, which I don't need to see it drawing, especially the electric bills where they are. So, you know of anything like that out there, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, Honeywell makes the control circuit that's input in many oil burner systems. And your Beckett retention head burner maybe didn't come with a more elaborate version. There is an elaborate version which uses the photocoupled, the photo cell, which looks for fire. And it knows whether or not fire is there, and it knows when to turn on and off the ignition transformer. The ignition transformer is that old 4-inch cube black thing, maybe 5-inch cube, which you put 110 volts on the primary, and it gives you something like 10,000 volts on the secondary. That, in turn, creates a spark across your ignition probes right in front of the nozzle. You've got these two sharp, steel-pointed things with a gap between them, something like 3/16 of an inch, if I remember, and a spark jumps across that, and that's what ignites the vaporized fuel coming out of your nozzle. And most of our oil burners, most of our oil burners, in order to be double damn sure that you've got a flame there, the ignition runs continuously. Yeah, that's burning up another amp or so of current, is what you're measuring, and it is slowly eroding those points, which means once every year or so you should check that gap. You might have to reset them. And if you're a serious person, you might have to file them down to a slightly sharper point. And so if you could turn those off, it would save you a little bit of electricity, which is not, in dollars per year, that's minor. It's going to save you some ignition noise. The spark, if you're running radio equipment alongside of an oil burner, you'll hear that arcing and sparking of that ignition system. Igniter, I guess it's usually called. So if you have the ability to turn it off, I see a slight problem here, Joe. That is, if you do turn it off after you're sure the fire has been established, and if a Long Island Lighting Company gives you an instantaneous interruption by which you get a flame out, and then the burner restarts, you could easily have the pumping vaporized fuel in there for a significant number of seconds before the photo cell telling the controller, hey, there's no flame here. And I think that photo cell circuit has got a time delay itself of, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 seconds. If it sees no light for 5 or 10 seconds, it turns the whole system off. But for those 5 or 10 seconds, you're going to be continuously pumping the vaporized fuel into the into your firebox. And one of the things you got to worry about is that if you do pump vaporized fuel in there for, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 seconds, let me drop, and then you get a delayed ignition, and now you you ignite that whole column of vaporized fuel that's not only in the firebox, but it's been running up your flue pipe and up the chimney, and you suddenly ignite that whole vaporized column of combustible materials, you can get one hell of a whoosh, and in some cases it can blow your flue pipes apart. To be on the double safe side, where your flue pipes are telescoping into each other, to something like a 5-inch diameter pipes, 5-6, something like that, where they telescope into each other, you should make sure that there is a sheet metal screw, at least one if not two sheet metal screws, forcing those telescoping pieces of flue pipe to absolutely be connected together. If you did get a flashback like I just described, and that whoosh of sudden flame separates those flue pipes, and then the burner continues to turn to crank with your flue pipes open and you're pumping exhaust gases in the house, depending on what fuel-air ratio you've got, you could be pumping carbon monoxide, you're certainly pumping burnt oil flue gases into the house, very unsafe. So when it comes to properly controlling, turning off the ignition transformer, making sure that the fire coming out of the nozzle is always lit and always has the maximum probability of being lit. The safest thing by far, Joe, as I see it, is to have the ignition circuit turned on continuously, and you suffer that extra amp of current drain. The number of dangers you could get into by cutting it off in the way you're describing, unless you've got a fairly intelligent circuit, one that's got a good track record, I worry a little bit. You see what I'm worried about here?
Repeater, timeout.
2QAQ with Conan.
You drag your feet. We're going to pick up Glenn and anyone else, because periodically we do have oil burner experts on frequency are going to tell us what to do. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm definitely not a oil burner expert, that's for sure. But just a question that I have in listening is, I would think, I could be completely wrong, but I would think that if you had a high voltage transformer, something that takes like 120 volts and then steps up to ignition voltage, that the normal position for that transformer would be off, and that whatever switches the primary on would only take place at ignition. I don't think that the high voltage is sitting there all the time, but I could be completely wrong. So it may not be as inefficient as you think. KC2QIQ.
From what you just said, Glenn, you've used good common sense. But when you do a further check of oil burner systems in domestic homes, a very high percentage of them run that ignition transformer continuously. Whenever the oil burner is fired, the ignition transformer is making a spark. And yes, it's 10,000 volts, intentionally a rather high resistance secondary winding on that ignition transformer, so that when you do get an arc across the igniters, the current drops down to some relatively low number, if you know what I mean. So it's consuming an amp at 110 volts is what Joe is measuring. So it's consuming 120 watts. That 120 watts, which is almost identical to what's going into his oil burner motor, pump, and fan assembly. It's a squirrel cage fan blowing in air. It's a gear pump that's supplying 100 or 150 pounds per square inch of oil into the nozzle. That's also drawing a little more than an ampere. So it's a good investment to have that ignition there continuously, because there's various ways that a sudden real great big gust, let me drop. A sudden great big gust of wind outside, creating an instantaneous vacuum on your chimney, could blow out the flame. It's unlikely, but it does happen occasionally. An interruption from loco could allow the flame to cease, and then the whole system comes back on again. So you'd have to have enough intelligence in that system that turns off the igniter, the transformer, high voltage to the igniters, such that it knows that whenever the burner is running and pumping in oil and air, that you better look for a fast leading edge of the photocell, looking for the brightness of the flame. And if it doesn't see that flame real soon, you want to cut off that oil and air supply, because if you start filling up your firebox, flue pipe, and chimney with an ignitable mixture, and then you suddenly ignite it, oh boy, can you get the, it's a minor kind of explosion. People call it a whoosh, but it's almost a bang at times. and it can separate flue pipes. It can separate your flue pipe from the chimney. It can do some pretty nasty things. In the worst case scenario, it might even take some of the loose bricks of your chimney and dislodge them. So, do we have other people with oil burner experience that know about methods of safely turning off the ignition transformer during the time your oil burner is firing? If you've got knowledge on that subject, please give us your call letters right now, K2LIW and the TechNet. And those...
Ignition by design for all the reasons you give, Dick. Over.
Okay. Was that Vito that I was hearing? Go ahead.
Who's that? K2GJE, over.
Okay, K2GJE. So in other words, I think you're saying you agree with me that methods of turning off that ignition transformer during the time you're firing, you're really doing it at great risk. The total amount of power you put into that igniter is small. Yes, it makes some electromagnetic interference. So you don't operate your radio equipment to 5 feet away from your oil burner. If you did, you'd be suffering quite a bit of static. But by far the safest technique is to have that ignition working continuously, because methods of turning it off is saving you pennies of electric bill, a little bit of difference in electromagnetic interference, but you're taking quite a significant risk. That's what I think you're saying. K2GJE, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Roger, Dick. I've threaded the leads that go to the... I don't have ignition transformer. I have a solid state, which I think most of the new burners have. I have threaded the leads through a toroid, twice through a toroid, and it greatly cuts down any RFI interference. Over.
I'm pretty sure, yeah, I think it's Ed that I'm talking to, Edwin. And so there's ways of cutting down the electromagnetic interference. But as I see it, Joe, go slow on turning that off, unless you're darn sure that you've got an awful lot of good intelligence in the circuit that's turning it off, and it has a fast attack time on the photocell saying, hey, there's no flame, and you want to react immediately to that, as opposed to the usual. Because many an oil burner, when it first comes on, for a whole bunch of reasons, the flame doesn't happen immediately. Therefore, the photocell circuit has a built-in delay. It will allow your oil burner to run a certain number of seconds before it creates an alarm and turns everything off. And let me give you a scenario as to how that can happen. Let me drop. If you were foolish like I am, where I buy oil on the spot market just like you do, Joe, and sometimes I cut it too close. Sometimes I allow the tank to drain all the way to the bottom. And now I've got to reprime the whole system. I've got a lot of air in the lines between the oil tank and the oil burner. And so if I wasn't smart enough to use my hand-operated vacuum pump in order to force the whole system to be properly primed with oil flowing through the whole thing after I get an oil delivery, if I wasn't doing that, and some of my friends will, when they run out of oil, will just get a delivery and keep punching the reset button and running the oil burner, you know, 20 seconds at a time, so to speak, until the pump finally cranks out all of the air in the system and finally gets to oil. So there's something like a 20-second delay on the photo circuit as it is. Well, once you've been firing the system, and you get an instantaneous outage and therefore a killing of the flame, and if you go back to that 20-second delay, and now you're pumping a fuel-air mixture into your chimney for 20 solid seconds, and then you suddenly ignite it, you can see what can happen. So they've got a delay in there to allow you to be able to force the system to prime itself. But in this particular circumstance that you're describing, I'm pretty sure you don't want that delay on the photo circuit. So go a little slow on this one, Joe, and study it before you actually do it. I hate to see you take the nice house you've got and mess it up with a minor explosion inside of the oil system. W-E-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-A-W, the TechNet.
Well, I understand. I don't understand the ramification of what you're talking about. But I've never had the thing not fire. I did. I had an intermittency, and it ended up being a transformer. I had the transformer replaced with something, you know, a lot newer that was like 25-something years old, since when the burner was actually put in. And that solved the problem. It stopped the intermittent problem. I had an intermittent ignition transformer. But the one now gives you about, I don't know what the current is, but it says the output is 17,000 volts. And the thing I also noticed about the points is it's eating up the points pretty quickly. I don't get a year out of a set of points. It seems to be much less than that, and it's actually, it chews it back quite a bit by the thing. That was another reason. But what I was simply asking is if you know of anybody that made a timer circuit without replacing the whole aquastat, like an add-on type of timer. Because I only need the thing to run for something like 10 or 15 seconds maximum, even 20 seconds maximum, at the same time the photo cell would run, like in that same time window, and then cut itself off. But if they don't make it, they don't make it. I don't know if I really could build something like that easily myself. The other question I had related to this thing was also, you had told me that there's a solenoid kit you can buy that goes on the output of the oil pump, that goes on the output of the oil pump, which will immediately cut off the supply of oil to the nozzle while your burner motor is spooling down as it, as it has power removed from it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That, in my opinion, Joe, is a rather important product. I think it's Beckett brand name, but I'm not sure. Sold by Sid Harvey. I wish I knew the name of it. I think I kept the package, so I guess I could, unfortunately, it's the other end of my basement, and it's buried in a bunch of stuff, so I'm not volunteering to tell you right now, but you go into Sid Harvey and you use the right words. This switch goes in the high-pressure line, the 100 pounds to 150 pounds per square inch, small diameter copper line. It goes in that line in series between the pump and the blast tube assembly, which goes to the nozzle. And the way it works is that when the burner has just been turned on, that switch is in the normally closed mode, and it stays closed for something like 3 or 4 seconds. In that 3 or 4 seconds, your pump is coming up to pressure, your squirrel cage blower is coming up to speed, and so by the time 3 or 4 seconds has flowed, has elapsed, let me drop. The whole system is now giving you full pressure, full air, and then it opens up and allows the oil to squirt out, and so now you're getting proper ignition with proper air-fuel mixture. If LUCO gives you an instantaneous dropout, or if the burner turns off, in either case, the switch closes immediately. It's a slow attack, fast decay switch commanding function, so to speak. The switch switch closes immediately. Therefore, as your burner, fuel pump, and squirrel cage blower is winding down, you're not dribbling oil out of the end of the nozzle under low pressure. The oil dribbling out of the end of the nozzle, if you don't have the switch, is a very dirty burn, which eventually gives you a great big chunk of coked material in the vicinity of the nozzle. And the fins that are around the nozzle are supposed to be controlling air. The whole system gets coked up with a really ugly-looking mess if you don't have the switch. The switch I'm talking about, I seem to remember it's like a $10 or $15 item. Very false economy not to have it on your oil-fired furnace for the house and an oil-fired furnace for hot water, in my case. It made a huge improvement. Let me drop.
I have a comment, Dick.
I'll be going over to John in a minute. I've been doing my own oil burner service for 40 years. And in those 40 years, on two occasions, an ignition transformer failed. I think the ignition transformers, I believe, from my experience, they have a finite life. Let me pick a number, 10 or 15 years of life, meantime between failures, so to speak. As such, I make sure I have a spare ignition transformer, because if I get a failure at 2 o'clock in the morning on a super cold night, I'd like to be able to replace that transformer right away without waiting for the oil burner parts store to open up the next morning. So I keep a spare of that, as well as spare nozzles that I experiment with a lower number of gallons per hour. And there's a huge advantage in doing that. We've had that discussion already. So you definitely want this cutoff switch solenoid. I've heard people give it various names. The nozzle solenoid, cutoff switch, and so on. But as you can see from the function it has, Joe, from my point of view, it's a very valuable thing. Many oil burners in the beginning, in the old days, did not have this. And so something you definitely want to add. Let me drop.
I have a question related to that, Dick.
Yeah, we've also got John in the wings. And that is, the only other problem I had is that in order for me to create the right kind of flare nut plumbing to insert this in that line, I'm probably not as skilled as I should be. And so the first couple of times I did it, I ended up with a slow leak. Lucky for me, I put a container under that assembly, which is outside of the firebox, outside of the oil burner assembly. You know, it's in that piece of external piece of copper tubing that comes out of your pump, goes into the side of the burner, and so that's where you put it. And I had trouble, as I remember, finding enough lead length to feed the 110 volts to it. It's fired with 110 volts, the same 110 volts that is turning on the motor of your pump and blower. And so I ended up with a very slow leak there until I finally made that flare nut fitting correct. It comes with the right adapters. In other words, the right male-female flare nut fitting and small piece of tubing and so on. All of that's in the package. And for whatever reason, the first time I did it, I had a slow leak. We're going to go to John and then back to Joe in that order. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Joe may want to check out a website for Fenwall, F-E-N-W-A-L-L, or Johnson Control Industries. They make all types of modules. They may have something exactly what he's looking for. Also, Paul might have information on that too, because I know he's worked in some boiler rooms. So maybe check with him. But Fenwall makes all types of controls, as Johnson Control Systems do. So that's a good place to start, I believe, for what he's looking for. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, by way of Fenwall and Johnson, you can probably buy it over the internet. However, he can get it immediately in his hand by walking into Sid Harvey, which is something he's done a few times. W-H-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, go right ahead, Joe.
No, I've never been into Sid Harvey yet. I was supposed to be at a store at Medford someplace. I've never actually been there yet, but I'm doing taking a trip out there. But that my question related to that was, and you sort of half-answered, I guess, was you sort of have to do this... more terminology, because more come out like burner. I know they say pre-made with the nuts on both ends already flared. If you break the thing or whatever, you can just go up there and like at Blackman's where I go to normally buy stuff and buy the direct replacement. So, but for what you're saying is this other thing comes in the kit, but you sort of have to do it yourself. Well, that's something I have to think about because I'm not into that type of field, and I don't really want to have a problem where I put something together and it's going to leak later on. So I got to think about that also. Exactly how would I get that task accomplished correctly? And I guess the last question related to this whole thing is, you said you run two filters in your system. Are they both canister type of filters? Because I only have one, but you said you have two in your system. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that? That'll be my last question related to this entire subject. Back to you.
Yeah, the two-filter technique, I think, is mine. I've never seen it written up in any of the manuals. And once I started doing that 10 years ago, to me, it's the best thing since baked bread. And I'll explain that in a minute. But let me go back to the switch. This is a solenoid switch time delay thing, which is a slow attack, fast decay. In other words, when the burner first comes on, it holds back the oil in that 100 pound per square inch pipe for about 3 seconds. Then it allows it through when your system is up to speed. But whenever the burner is turned off by your thermostat or loco dropping power or whatever, that switch closes instantaneously in milliseconds, interrupting the oil so that it doesn't dribble out of the end of the nozzle as your pump slows down, as it winds down. And I made it sound too complicated. Let me drop. Installing it is nowhere near as difficult as I made it sound. And if it's going to leak, it leaked, in my case, immediately. It wasn't something that developed a slow leak later on. It leaked immediately. And then I tried tightening the flare nut fittings and whatever, and until I got everything set up correctly, I couldn't stop the leak. And the leak was a very slow leak. You know, one trip every 10 seconds, so to speak. But don't worry about it suddenly developing a leak downrange. You will definitely get leaks downrange in an oil burner system if you're foolish enough to use compression fittings. Never, never use compression fittings on the oil pipes on an oil burner. Must be flare nut fittings. The vibration around an oil burner is such that compression fittings will always get you a leak at some time downrange as the vibration loosens up that whole system. By the same token, all of the fittings for the high-pressure brake lines on your automobile must be either single or double flare nut fittings, never a compression fitting. Now, when it comes to the filtering, almost everybody has the conventional canister filter. I think it's model number 1A or something like that. And it's got this great big felt thing inside. It's a gray filter, which looks about five layers of a, what do you call that kind of a cake? A layer cake. It's a five-layer cake where the alternate layers are larger and smaller in diameter. That tip filter does a very good job of course filtering your oil, and there's always sludge in the oil no matter who you buy it from. Let me drop. You can buy the most expensive oil or the cheapest oil. It's always coming from the same place, and there's always some tar and sludge and sand and everything else. I mean, at the end of the year when you change that filter, the gunk that's in that can is just out of sight. And you thank your lucky stars that none of that got into your oil burner system and tried to wend its way through your nozzle where it clogs up the daylights out of things. Okay, that filter does a very good job up to a point. The extremely fine sand and grit that's always in the oil does get through that filter. A little bit of it does. They make a microfine filter. That's my name for it. I don't know the... I give you the model number of the filter, but when you're sitting in Sid Harvey and you look at this shelf full of filters, this very fine white foam filter does an extremely good job of taking out those fine particles. That's the good news. But if you put that filter into the system, it will clog in 2 weeks. You'll be changing the damn filter element every 2 weeks. So by cascading two filter canisters, I've added the second canister to my system. I've now got a coarse filter and a fine filter. Coarse filter takes out 95% of the sludge. The 5% of the fine stuff, which eventually creates wear of your nozzle, I'm now filtering that out with the fine filter. If you ever take a nozzle apart, you'll be amazed what kind of microscopic, physical, acoustic, and acoustic's not the word, hydraulic circuitry is inside of that thing. Let me drop. That nozzle, the inner components of that nozzle, in order to give you the right number of gallons per hour, with the right flare angle, with either a solid cone or a hollow cone, and each burner has an ideal kind of nozzle. The circuitry is inside that nozzle. If you take it apart and look it under a microscope, a good stereo zoom microscope, you say, holy cow, these guys have been in microcircuitry a long time ago, and this is just a simple hydraulic system that's squirting oil into an oil burner. As such, you really want the fine grit not to get into that, because 100 or 150 pounds per square inch oil with fine grit is really slowly eroding that nozzle and its quality, if you know what I mean. So that fine filter makes that a lot nicer. A smart person, because the nozzle is not that expensive, is going to replace the nozzle every year, whether you need it or not. But at the end of the year, when you replace the nozzle under normal circumstances, it's starting to degrade because of the fine grit eroding the darn thing. In my case, at the end of the year when I replace the nozzle and I look in there, the quality of that flame is the same as it was when I put in that nozzle brand new because of this cascaded filter. Let me drop. When you're in Sid Harvey and you buy both of these canisters in which you're going to put the fine filter second and the coarse filter first, at the place of the fine filter, the bolt that goes through that canister to hold the top and the bottom together of the canister. It's a cylindrical object with the upper surface open at the bottom of the canister, and that in turn gets sucked up to the header assembly, so to speak, that seals it off and filters inside, and the oil flows through that. Okay, that bolt that goes down the center, you can buy a replacement bolt that's hollow, where you can now put a vacuum gauge in the top of it. Lots of people worry about the fact that the filters in their system are eventually going to clog. And now they're, in order to be doubled on sure, they're either replacing the filter a couple of times per year, or they wait until the Don filter completely clogs, and they got no heat at 3 o'clock in the morning on a cold winter night. Both of those are terrible solutions. By buying that hollow bolt with the vacuum gauge in the top of it, and now you look at the vacuum. The vacuum tells you how hard the oil pump is working to suck oil from your line through those filters all the way back to the oil tank. So whether the line is clogged, whether the filter is clogged, it doesn't matter. When you see that vacuum gauge starting to climb above 5 to 7 pounds per square inch of vacuum, when you start seeing that, you know that somewhere in the system it's going to clog, and now you can start doing preventive maintenance. You've got quantitative information as to how the oil flow is flowing through the system, as opposed to waiting until it fully clogs or just changing filters like they're going out of style. I'd much rather know with my gauges. I've got a gauge on the pump that shows me that 150 pounds per square inch is going into the nozzle. I've got a gauge on my filter assembly.
Repeater, timeout.
I've got a gauge on my filter assembly that's telling me how hard the pump is sucking in order to get oil between the pipe from the tank through the pipe from the tank to the burner through the filters. I now know how hard the pump is working to suck fuel in, and so I've now got quantitative information, if you know what I mean. Let's see how all of that made sense to you, Joe. W2LYY, good questions. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a vacuum gauge on my single filter. It does have that. I typically run about 3 inches of vacuum, give or take. I've seen it go up in the past, and I've had to clean out the oil line by putting pressure back in the oil line, and that pretty much solved that problem. So, okay, I think you pretty much answered most of my questions. I got a phone ring in the background also I'm going to have to attend to. But, that's about it. If I could, there is something else. You said you turn up the oil pressure on the pump. That's something I have not noticed where that actually is. Your pump is probably similar to mine. Any comments on that?
Yeah, the actual pump, there's only two of them. Sunstrand or something like that is one of the most popular brands. If you get the book, if you download the article on nozzles, and you guys get a better memory than me, what's the brand name of the most popular nozzles that has this downloadable 20-page article that tells you everything you want to know about oil nozzles? What's that brand name, John? You probably can tell me.
I don't remember.
Delvan. I thought I heard. D-E-L-V-A-N. You Google the word Delvan, one of the most popular companies making nozzles, and you read that 20 pages. When you finish reading those 20 pages, you're going to say, yeah, I want to do that. Almost everybody's oil burner in the old days was set at exactly 100 pounds per square inch. And one of your little slugs in the oil pump assembly is a place where you unplug that little plug and you plug in your pressure gauge. It'll tell you exactly what pressure is going into the nozzle. There's a screw adjustment on the side of the pump. As you turn it clockwise, you'll watch that pressure go from 100 to 140 or 150 pounds. Depending on which article you read, 140 or 150 is the right number. When you read that Delvan article, you're going to say, yes, I want to do that. They'll convince you that almost any of the nozzles you buy, when you pump 150 pounds per square inch, you get a much finer mist out of that nozzle. You may buy, in my case, 6/10 of a gallon per hour nozzle, at 100 pounds per square inch. And when you're putting 150 pounds per square inch, it doesn't go up proportionally. There's Reynolds numbers here. Instead of 6 tenths, it probably goes up to 7 tenths of a gallon per hour. But you now get much finer atomization. With much finer atomization, you now have the ability to do a much better job of adjusting the fuel-air mixture. I'll give you a couple of words on that. Let me drop. When you're running a nozzle at 100 pounds,